Have your say in ExchangeWise Industry Review APAC, our in-depth view of the hottest issues impacting the region. Comment on one of six topics: walled gardens, gaming, retail media, the service layer, the open web and CTV, and join ExchangeWire in driving the industry forward. Email info at exchangewire.com to get involved.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Brawson, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by this week's special guest, who is Alex Williams, Head of Growth and Personalization at M&S. Hello to you, Alex.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you on. And completing our trio for this morning's podcast is ExchangeWire CEO and co-founder Rachel Smith, who is also a leading connoisseur of Tim Tams. Hello to you, Rachel.
Always getting the Tim Tam mention in there. Hello.
Absolutely. Can't go without it.
Well, I mean, who can? That's exactly all I'm going to say about the Tim Tam.
Exactly. Diving into this week's first news story, Netflix will reportedly charge brands an industry-high CPM of $60 to advertise on their upcoming ad-supported tier. The price point is predicted to hit $65 before eventually climbing to $80, according to the Wall Street Journal. The streaming heavyweight reportedly wants advertisers to commit to year-long contracts in line with broadcast TV networks, with brands needing to spend $20 million to secure deals, although it's unclear whether this figure is the minimum or maximum the platform is aiming for. The move is a bold one, considering that Netflix's AVOD offering is untested, will reportedly debut with limited capabilities, and won't allow brands to choose specific shows for their ads to run alongside. Inventory will instead be offered by genre. Microsoft-owned Xandr will be responsible for measuring impressions, and previous reports claim that the amount of adverts will be limited to 4 minutes per hour. So my first question to you guys here is, will advertisers accept this lofty price tag, and is Netflix taking a risk here? Rachel, let's start with you.
Well, I mean, I can't wait to hear what Alex is going to say about this. Working for a big high street brand, he might have some opinions on whether he thinks advertisers are going to stump up the cash for these, for these high price points. Will they? My opinion on will they do it? I kind of feel like advertising. I mean, the whole idea of advertising arriving on the Netflix platform has been one of the most talked about stories in the world of digital advertising for years, right? The speculation of would they, wouldn't they? Now, finally, they've come to the marketplace saying, yep, we're going to be running advertising on a platform. Everybody, I think, is, you know, desperately scrabbling around to imagine what that's going to look like, what the whole advertising experience will look like from a consumer point of view, and then what obviously the advertisers are going to be able to get out of that advertising experience. So all of those things are incredibly nuanced and detailed, and we need to know a lot more information about that, I think, before we could really honestly speculate about how well their advertising offering is going to go. But from a basic level, do I think advertisers will pay those prices? I think some will, right? Because I think what's going to happen with Netflix is a case of FOMO. You know, people will feel like it is a place they need to be, and they'll at least want to experiment with the advertising budgets on the platform to see what happens next. And I can only imagine that that's the opinion within Netflix as well, because they are so obviously incredibly confident about their offering that they're prepared to go in at this kind of level in, as you said, Matt, a relatively untested environment. And I mean, I don't know about you guys, so I'm interested in both of your points of view on this, and especially you, Alex, working for a big brand like Marks & Spencer. I don't know what your experiences are of consuming advertising in a streaming and online platform, but mine are really patchy. So as an advertiser, I just would want to be so convinced that Netflix are getting this right. So I think it's a really interesting debate to be pondering at this moment.
Yeah, totally. I mean, those points really resonate. $65 as a starting point feels like a pretty high number, right? Higher than the Super Bowl was this last year, to put into perspective. I think Disney had come out saying they were at $50. So just to give some comparative point, but actually like not too far off that where Disney are positioning themselves. As you said, Rachel, it comes back to a question of, do you want to be on the platform that probably has the biggest reach, most engagement globally across the widest set of demographics, or do you not? The challenge, if I think from an M&S perspective or from a bigger brand perspective, is the ability to understand whether you're actually reaching the customers that you want to reach. And that seems very opaque from what's been released so far. And it seems that in the initial stage, that measurement is going to be very limited. And your understanding, not even of one-to-one, but the types of people that you're reaching, also very limited, which in the environment that we're in today, lots of cost pressures across the industry, particularly within the space that I work in, retail, I think they're going to be hard conversations internally if you can't really prove those returns.
That's one of the things that's fascinating about this story, right? Is that not only are they coming straight out the gate with these really high CPM price points, but they're also openly stating that they're not going to be accepting third-party measurement platforms, integrations with third-party measurement platforms. I mean, that's really bold, right?
It is. I have to say that when you see any quotes from the Netflix team on this, I think they haven't got it quite worked out yet. Like, this feels very early days from a Netflix perspective. They've spent more of their time focused on what the consumer proposition is going to be. And they've really made that clear that this is about creating a lower entry price point at the $7 to $9 range versus the sort of $15 average price point over in the US. And that that's really what the proposition is here, is to create that user and subscriber growth for them. And so it feels as if there's been a lot of work on the consumer side of the proposition. And if I think about some of the conversations that could be happening internally at Netflix, what is it that you need to fund that price discount? And is this like a calculation backwards to create these really big numbers? And at the end of the day, if you think about the positioning of such a high price point at $60 to $65 USD, you can come down from that. And that's a good news story. It feels like the right place to anchor, like a sensible starting point, particularly if you've not got all the details worked out just yet.
Yeah, I completely agree there. And I think coming back to that Disney example you flagged earlier, Alex, in terms of the $50, that's for, I think, targeting people ages 2+. So obviously, if you go a bit more niche in targeting, obviously those CPMs are going to go high. So I think, yeah, Netflix have adopted a bit of a wait and see approach. And obviously with Disney's pricing a little more clear, then they've, you know, obviously solidified around, you know, their $60 mark. But in terms of that content, yes, it's got that quality content. I'm interested to get your guys' perspectives in them not allowing advertisers to run against specific shows and instead doing so by genre.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting approach, right? Because also too, I was just having a look this morning when I was sort of doing an extra little bit of thinking about some of these news stories, having a look through my LinkedIn feed, and I noticed quite a few people commenting on, you know, the Netflix CPM news story. And one of my LinkedIn contacts mentioning that they are already really reticent to share a lot of data and information, even on the show production side of the business. So they don't share basically viewer stats in terms of which shows are ranking above other shows with show creators and show runners, so they can't understand who's beating them and where the audience is going. So I find it really interesting that then their advertising offering is going to be focused on genre. Surely if they were going to do that, they'd be willing and able to share a lot of information about who is viewing that type of genre of shows. And I'm assuming that that probably is information that will come forward at some stage. But, I mean, you used the word earlier on, Alex, opaque, and I do feel like a lot of this is shrouded in a bit of opacity for the moment. And maybe it is, as you said, it's about them going sort of out the gate first with their consumer approach and perhaps scrabbling around internally to work out the mechanics of this. But it leaves me with a lot of question marks, basically. And from the point of view of, you know, what value do brands get from that, advertising in a genre-style environment as opposed to a sort of targeted demographic environment? Well, we need some measurement tools to be able to tell us, right, to be able to give us the results of that.
It's always an interesting shift, right, when you move from a business that's a closed system, entirely closed ecosystem with all of their understanding and effectively creating this flywheel inside of understanding of content, understanding of audience and what resonates to them being able to decide what to produce next, to them moving to an ads model where now you have to open up your publishers, audience, advertisers, they all want to understand actually what's going on inside the platform. And so I think that's a very core strategic question for them to look to answer. It's interesting when you come back to some of the limitations on targeting, because again, it feels very consumer driven in the way that they're approaching this. You know, they put a line in the sand that 4 minutes of advertising per hour, that's significantly less than anyone else who offers advertising. And, you know, as we experience in the UK, but particularly even over in the US and with Hulu, sort of 10 to 20 minutes of advertising per hour of broadcasting. So it feels like they're really just trying to start off slowly, learn as they go. And then I'd expect a lot of change as we see this roll out.
That's a really good point as well, though, Alex. It makes me think about whether this model will start to become differentiated, the ad model, the pricing, the structuring, the volume of ads, whether that will become differentiated across markets. Because we talk quite a lot when we talk about a TV advertising context, the tolerance for ads, for example, here in the UK versus the US, we all know, and in fact, you know, streaming platforms like Netflix have taught us this, that programs that were scheduled for an hour in the US are never an hour of content. At absolute best, they're maybe 40 minutes. Some of them are even less than that, right? And that's not the advertising world that people are used to here in the UK, although maybe we'll become, you know, our tolerance levels might change over time. And so then what does that look like in other international markets? Because, and this is, I suppose, another interesting point from a strategic point of view, you know, wondering where Netflix is coming from here. Where they were looking for subscriber growth for the last couple of years was internationally and developing markets. It's not that they haven't had some success in entering those developing markets, but they've got a lot of competition in some of those markets where they thought it would be a bit easier. So what is their advertising model going to look like across some of those international markets going forward? Because those marketplaces have got completely different levels of tolerance, completely different budget expectations. Be really interesting to see, right?
Exactly. And there's a really interesting point around metrics here, I think, because if we look at what is the main driver of Netflix's share price growth over time, it's all about subscribers. So even when they introduce the new ad tier, it's all about how this supports in growing that subscriber number. And that's everything that everyone hinges their value on. If you contrast that with Disney, much more established business. Yes, they have a subscription model, but really all of their investors are looking at return on capital employed, profitability, some of the more standard traditional metrics. And so really for them, they have to take a different approach. And when you look at how they're looking to introduce ads, they're taking the current price as the base, adding ads into that, so diminishing that experience for those consumers, and then creating a new premium tier to pay away, which for me just perfectly aligns with how Netflix think about subscribers and Disney probably more focused on profitability. But I'm sure that conversation is going to be catching Netflix up pretty quickly too.
100%.
Yeah, absolutely. That will be hugely interesting to see how they develop their platform going forward. Moving into the second news story of the week. New regulations set to be introduced by the EU could have a serious impact on brands, warn ad industry bodies. The new policies will set out a new definition of what constitutes political advertising and will force big tech platforms and political parties to divulge how they target prospective voters. Both IAB Europe and the Centre for Data Innovation have expressed concerns about the phrasing of the proposals, particularly those related to the definition of political advertising. They also warn that the new policy could overlap with GDPR, causing confusion and potentially unintentional breaches by advertisers. My first question to you guys here is what impact could these new regulations have and what needs to be done to help brands navigate them? Alex, let's start with you on this one.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I mean, this is in the context of there being a huge amount of focus on this specific area of regulation around privacy and how companies are using data in various different ways. And I think there's a lot of focus on this area, but it's a really new and difficult area. All of the regulation that I'm seeing come in across this space is coming from a really good place. But as it's so new, the reality is regulation has to be tested and adapted over time. And so I think many of the bodies are trying to implement what they think is the right thing in the right direction, but there's probably a few more questions that need to be answered as we go. And I think this applies across borders, within borders, lots of overlap that still sits there that will need to be resolved. If I think about political advertising challenges specifically and some of the concerns that have been raised so far with this specific regulation, there's a clear distinction that's being made between paid for political advertising and not paid for political content, which feels really well intentioned and the right thing to do and solves part of the challenge, but again, probably not all of the challenge that's there, because there's still the opportunity for political misinformation through organic content. It doesn't have to be paid for, but maybe it's just not amplified in the same way. So I can see the sort of positive impact of where they're trying to go with that. There's a really interesting point around one of the concerns being on the phraseology of commercial marketing messaging falling under the definition of political, which I think is one of the things that people are concerned about in how that legal text actually ends up manifesting. And I wasn't too sure how to take this, because for me, that makes me assume that maybe some of the language in our standard marketing actually could be deemed as political in its persuasiveness or in the way that it's trying to influence people, which is almost an entirely different challenge to solve, it feels like. But from a brand perspective, I think the core challenge, operational challenge that could come from something like this are introduction of new definitions of personal data. Feels like we'd sort of resolved that through GDPR, through the e-privacy directive that's currently going through a couple of reviews, and that we'd actually made good progress there. And so having subtexts that have new definitions just becomes really hard for us to solve internally. And so it's that overlapping that as I think about my role at M&S as one of our customer data owners, how are we actually going to absorb that if regulation and interpretation starts to change again?
Yeah, I think, Alex, you've articulated some really interesting points that make me feel as though this story is not one that's just about the specificity of legislation relating to political advertising, but it's also trying, I think, taking a stab at trying to clarify both in terminology and just in outright definition, the difference between marketing materials and, like you said, you know, political persuasion and political points of view in a very digitized landscape. You know, obviously this doesn't just apply to digital messaging and digital advertising, but you know, we so much of what we consume is very digitized anyway. And I think this is an environment that's just becoming increasingly complex. And so I kind of think that it's good that we are that various authorities are trying to bring legislation like this forward. But also then hearing you express from a brand point of view who has legal responsibility for customer data and needs to understand what those responsibilities are, hearing you express, you know, concern that this will be more complicated for you, at least in the short term, makes me feel as though perhaps this just isn't, you know, we're at the start of this journey. I think as a group of regulatory bodies, as a society that is becoming more and more digitized, as a collection of, say, digital information and news platforms who are struggling to, adhere to their own legislative pressures around what's legal, what's illegal, what's appropriately categorized and worded and what's not. I feel like we're just at the start of all of that, and we've got a lot of sort of messy things to try to clarify and clear up here, and it's going to take some time. And in, you know, I think you mentioned it as well, Alex, the whole point of legislation is that it gets drafted, it gets debated, it gets redrafted, it gets adopted, and then it has to be tested. And if we think about GDPR, I feel like we're now, you know, what is it? How old did GDPR turn this year? Was it four?
Four, I think.
Yeah, four. I feel like we're now only just at a place now with GDPR where pretty much most businesses and organisations, including public sector bodies, now finally understand what their responsibilities are, and the legislation's been tested a little bit in many ways. And we're only, that's great. But therefore, I think we're only just, if we're talking about the introduction of new legislation, and this particular piece of legislation relates to political advertising, this is the start of that journey. It's going to take a number of years, I think, before we really understand how this plays out in a practical sense. And also, just one final thought I've got on this is the way that you expressed that Alex, that, you know, the definition of marketing messages versus political advertising makes you think about how your marketing messages are constructed in the first instance. Reminds me that, you know, in a previous career when I didn't work in media and advertising and marketing tech, I worked in the public sector. And we used to deal with really high volumes of demographic data for the purposes of targeting public sector services. So we weren't targeting marketing messages and advertising, but we were targeting services to those that needed them the most. Well, it's the same thing. You know, we were using Experian data. We were using profiling and modeling that is used routinely and regularly in marketing and advertising just for different purposes. So in a way, they're sort of, you know, they're sort of either side of the same coin. Marketing and promotion, political persuasion, arguments, debates. And it is really interesting to think about it from that point of view. The line is so fine, as we well know, from the way that we consume data and the way that we consume information.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Rachel. And I'd argue that the problem is that it's not a line. It's this big gray area between the two. And actually, one of the things that I've been pleasantly surprised by, particularly with the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK, is actually a real pragmatism in dealing with the evolution of the regulation. Taking the questions, taking the concerns of retailers, other industries and other brands, so that you can look to adapt over time and start to work out how you narrow that gray area and maybe create a little bit more of a harder line between them, but inherently difficult.
100%. And also then it starts to raise questions of at what point do you sort of veer into the world of censorship? This is the whole purpose, to have legislation around political messaging and political advertising, because you want to have an unrestrained environment where political messaging can get out there into the world and people can clearly articulate, you know, from a political standpoint, what they intend to do in terms of, you know, public sector infrastructure and public service delivery. And if you I'm using emotive marketing words here, aren't we? If you try to control that too much, then you start to, you know, edge into censorship territory. On the other hand, I think we all accept that legislative controls need to be in place to protect society, right? We don't, you know, there needs to be some level of censorship, and it's just a case of where those markers are between what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, and also how that gets controlled by the legislators of the day, because, you know, the irony in all of this is that they become politically influenced as well.
Yeah, there's something really interesting in one of the points you mentioned there, particularly around engagement of the wider base of people in politics as a subject. And is that inherently a bad thing to have messages out there and people understanding, whether it be what political parties stand for, or the example that you gave of various parts of the civil service infrastructure and things going on in a person's local area? The challenge is that it's so often demonized, when actually politics is probably one of the areas that is most read about, most discussed within society, and cuts across all parts of society. And so this is really important in lots of ways. There's an issue that I feel it becomes a little bit more challenging as new parts of regulation are introduced, which is actually as a larger company, a larger brand, you have the resources to deal with these changes ongoing, and you can look to adapt. You have a data protection officer, you have governance in place to be able to look to interpret, a legal team to support. But when you're a smaller organization, either small persistently or smaller brand that's looking to grow, this becomes really hard to navigate. And so often increasing amounts of regulation actually look to hurt the smaller companies the most, because they sort of make that competition between them actually a little bit more difficult, because there's so many more things to watch out for over time, which I think is something not always intuitive. You always think regulation would maybe be harder for the big companies because there's so many bits that they have to solve. But I think sometimes actually as a smaller brand, it becomes quite challenging.
I think that's a really good point. And it's also not just brands that get, in this particular example, it's not just brands that get caught up in that either. I think the article made the point that depending on where they're going to place the responsibility with respect to this legislation in terms of how you can control messaging and targeting, it could be publishers that are running ads on their site that wind up with the responsibility of how those ads got targeted in certain areas into certain demographics from a contextual point of view, and they don't always have control over that. And if you're a small publisher, like you've just said, you don't have the resources to deal with that either. So that's some of the things that I think really need to be focused on from a legislative point of view when they're trying to think about not just how the legislation applies, but how they're actually going to, in effect, police adhering to it. The whole point being to try to not make it so onerous for small organisations that it negatively disadvantages them.
Absolutely. And I think that communication between the legislative bodies and brands, publishers across the entire industry, no matter how large or small they are, is critical going forward, especially when you've got other major pieces of legislation coming in. Obviously, Digital Markets Act, Digital Services Act. You know, we've had 4 years dealing with GDPR, and that's just one piece of legislation. Now having a trio of them on the plate, I think that communication is necessary to iron out these definitions and iron out any particular issues as they arise. Yes, we shall see how that transpires going forward. Moving into the third news story of the week. Shopify has told merchants to avoid using Buy with Prime, saying that the checkout option violates their terms of service. The one-click service, which was launched by Amazon in April this year, allows third-party sellers to offer speedy checkout and delivery provided under the e-commerce giant's Prime subscription. Shopify says that the integration breaches its terms of use, which stipulate that merchants must use Shopify checkout for any sales associated with your online store. The Canadian e-commerce heavyweight also warned that Buy with Prime could pose a risk to customers by making their data vulnerable to theft by Amazon or potentially causing them to be charged incorrectly for purchases. My first question to you guys is, why has Shopify issued this warning and how do you think Amazon will respond? Rachel, let's start with you.
Shopify has issued this warning because this is directly competitive with their own merchant checkout solution. And Amazon will respond by, I think, doing nothing. that's my brief summary of the position. This is a Shopify versus Amazon, merchant issue. And actually, we're seeing so many merchants and payment solutions pop up all over the show. It's kind of not surprising that it's come to this. I don't at all blame Shopify for taking the position that they're taking. They're trying to use any mechanisms they can to encourage their customers not to use the Buy with Prime merchant offering and instead use their own merchant offering so that they can control that transaction more, presumably so that they can, firstly make use of their own merchant tools and checkout tools and so forth, and also so that they can probably control that customer data as well. And they just don't want Prime crawling all over that end of their business. And I also kind of don't blame them for using the other tactic, apart from saying that this would be in breach of their terms and conditions, but also saying, and plus you don't want to give your data to Amazon, they're not trustworthy. I found that kind of equally amusing and understandable, because I think if I was Shopify, I'd be doing the same thing. Prime, like I said, I don't think they'll do anything about this unless forced to. So this may come down to a regulatory issue because, you know, if Shopify, depending, I suppose, on how things shape out, would Shopify maybe put some kind of, I don't know, anti-competition complaint forward to the various regulators in the US or in North America and say that Amazon's trying to dominate the sort of merchant ecosystem and steal their business? I don't know, but I don't really think that they'll do anything about it unless forced to. I think it's an out and out sort of online merchant checkout services infrastructure battle, handbags at dawn. And I'm kind of not surprised that Shopify have taken the position they've taken.
I think that's completely right. And really, if we think about one of the reasons as to why this is actually quite challenging, it's because Toby Lütke, their founder and CEO, actually said he was okay with it earlier this year. And so that's part of, I think, what's turned this into maybe something bigger than it sort of would have been, because actually talking to some of the internal teams, they're now saying, well, that was only his opinion. Now, Toby Lütke is a very, very smart person. And I think conceptually, him sharing that, look, this isn't a zero-sum game, us introducing Amazon Buy with Prime like into our system is good for us and is good for them. And there is possibly some cannibalization there, but maybe that's like a trade-off you'd be willing to make. I'm assuming that actually some of the internal teams have looked at some of the numbers. And now Shopify, the second problem is Shopify are really big now. They're not the small guys anymore. So in 2021, Shopify had 175 billion gross merchandise volume, which is about 45% of Amazon's marketplace volume. So it's hard now for them to claim, oh, let's like fuel our growth with Amazon. It's actually becoming a core strategic question as to whether they want to do that. And so Shopify are stepping on Amazon's turf in lots of ways anyway. They're acquiring Deliver, moving into logistics. And so the two companies really are looking to fight it out. And yeah, it's going to be different conversations internally now about where do they want to partner and then where do they actually want to try and draw a hard line between them and get the users to use their specific part of the product, in this case, Shopify Pay.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I was also trying to think about this from a consumer point of view. You know, if you're shopping on the Shopify platform, do you sort of care about the payment merchant? I mean, you probably do in that you want to trust them, right? So you want it to be known. Well, unfortunately, Amazon Prime is just as known as Shopify is. So there's no disadvantage there from Amazon's point of view. And I kind of think that you'll go with whatever you think is most trustworthy and reliable, particularly for delivery services as well. On the other hand, I could see that if you were already an Amazon Prime customer, you might just very easily be lured into thinking, oh, yeah, I'll do this kind of whole one-click buy with Prime option and I know that I can trust what's going to happen next. And it makes me wonder, actually, but why the Shopify CEO said that in the first instance. Like you said, you know, known for being a pretty intelligent person, it makes me wonder whether that was just sort of part of this narrative of we believe in an open ecosystem, we believe in an open competitive marketplace. You know, we're very happy with the idea of Amazon bringing all these customers to our marketplace. And now everybody, like you said, internally have sort of gone, that's actually not a good idea because we're so much more competitive now than we were, say, 12 months ago.
Exactly. And that cannibalization to sort of growth trade-off, I think, is becoming a really big thing. That you mentioned trust in some of the thoughts that you just shared, which I think is really important here. Like if I come back to what creates a fast and great checkout experience, I think it hinges on trust and speed. Interestingly, and I don't think that I fully agree with this, but if you look when US consumers were surveyed as to their most trusted brands, number one was the US Postal Service. Believable, understandable. Number two was Amazon. And number three was Google, which is probably the one that surprised me the most. But there's something very interesting of the power, even just of the Amazon brand and badging, at that as part of that experience and the role that plays and the trust that it creates. I think the second thing around streamlining and speed of checkout, the ability for a customer, if we assume 90% of customers are typically unknown for most brands, could be a little higher, a little lower, depending on how big your company is. If you get to the checkout experience and you're able to populate all of those details with one click because you're pulling that through from your Amazon Prime account, I can see the business case internally, you know. If it doesn't take many percentage points of movement in that conversion rate at checkout for you to go, this is a no-brainer for us to integrate. And so I think that's a little bit of what's playing out here.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And actually, you know, sort of on the trusted brands thing, that's a really interesting point, I think, about the brand perception of Amazon, specifically in the US as well, you know, being obviously, you know, US origin company. We had a conversation on a podcast a couple of months ago now about the idea of Amazon, a story came out about Amazon picking up healthcare services. So delivering sort of, you know, telehealth, basically. You can contact your GP through your Amazon account or whatever, or another health professional that might be required that you might be wanting to speak to. And actually our reaction to that at the time, I remember, because I was on that podcast that day too, I remember thinking, there's no way I'd trust Amazon with that level of personal detail. You know, they're not a trustworthy company when it comes to your personal data. but I think they might be perceived completely differently in the US. And that's not to say that I don't trust Amazon at all. I'm a big user of Amazon services. I'm an Amazon Prime member. I checkout experience, last mile delivery. I'm the one click shopper, right? But I wouldn't want them to have my healthcare data. I have a little bit of, suspicion about how they manage and control data. But I wonder if that exists at all in the US. You're quite right about that. Maybe people just associate that brand with, I don't know, success, and they implicitly trust it.
Yeah, possibly. It's interesting. It fully resonates with me. I feel the same way. I think there's only a handful of companies in the UK that I trust my data with, and it feels that interestingly globally, the company that lots of people are saying they're okay with it for is Apple, who have somehow over the last years managed to create a narrative which I think could be well-intentioned internally, which is we think that data stored on a device for as long as it isn't passed back to any other companies or downstream or outside of that device platform, that's what we define as privacy. Many consumers seem to be okay with that. And the way that Apple's positioned itself as a trustworthy user of that data, they haven't done a whole heap with that data yet. But I think in the coming years, as they look to introduce health services in a similar way, build out billions of dollars in ad revenue, probably some of those questions start to come up again as to, hold on, how are they different to some of the other companies that are actually looking to use my data to often improve my experience?
100%. And, you know, if my co-founder Kieran was on this podcast, he would very much say that Apple have employed some brilliant use of marketing messages in putting themselves forward as the shining light in the world of privacy and data privacy and protecting consumer privacy, and that they're doing that all for their own internal monetary benefits down the road. But I mean, yeah, I agree with you. And you know, Apple has created an ecosystem, and that's what I think it is that people feel firstly invested in. You know, they have a number of devices that make their lives easier. That means that they're intrinsically linked to that ecosystem. And that's what also makes them feel as though it's a trusted environment. But yes, I think many of us would argue they just don't know the detail.
Yeah. There's something super important as well in that though, Rachel, which is the Apple have acquired all of this data and created that trust by offering huge amounts of value back to the consumers and users of their products. Like if I think about Apple Pay, just how that has changed my life, how much easier that makes things. And there's such a clear value exchange for me there. And even though working in this space, I know where that data is going and the sorts of things that it could be used for, I'm much more comfortable with that because of what I get back. I think one of the challenges that you see when you look across the market, if I take the example, say, of a Walmart Pay, which is Walmart trying to replicate their version of Amazon in the US with probably pretty high levels of trust from the average American consumer. It's hard to see what the additional value is from a proposition like that. So for those not familiar, Walmart Pay, digital wallet, you add money into that digital wallet, you go and check out in the physical store, QR code comes up, you scan that QR code and it checks out immediately. So in lots of ways, very similar to an Apple Pay or a Google Pay, but just within the Walmart ecosystem so that they can be capturing that data. But I think that only really works because Apple Pay and Google Pay is less developed in many of the American markets. And so you see companies trying different things, like how do they build that trust? Like how do they build that direct relationship with the customer? But unless you can solve for huge amounts of value to give back, I think that's just increasingly challenging.
I agree. Or unless the narrative around the way in which we look after our own personal data and whom we give it to and why we give it to them, unless that narrative changes significantly, which it could do, depending on how the world of data privacy unfolds over the coming years. What I mean by that is I think that consumers are just becoming a lot more aware of what their data is used for and a lot more interested in where that data is going. And I completely concur with the experience you've just, you know, described, right? Like if you're an iPhone user, your life is dramatically simplified by Apple Pay, and that is what you use to pay for pretty much everything. If you're an Android user, it's all about Google Pay. Why would you download and use a Walmart wallet? You probably wouldn't for convenience sake per se, unless you spend a lot of time in Walmart, or unless you start to think to yourself, actually, maybe I don't want just one digital sort of provider to have all of my data. Maybe I need to understand what they're using that data for and only allow them to use it for X, and then I'll use my Walmart wallet for when I'm in Walmart. And then, and also there's the paranoia over, I suppose, accounts getting hacked. It's a bit like back in the days where you only ever used to have one debit card, and then suddenly it became a good idea to maybe have another account, another debit card in case one got stolen or what have you. It's interesting watching the journey of how people are understanding that and how it's correlating with their consumer behavior, because I think we've got some more changes to come over the next couple of years.
I think this is such an interesting point, the idea that we could get to a stage where there is a general understanding of your own data, how it could be used, that consumers are taking an active choice to say, I actually want to control that and divide that up in some way. Because really, any individual data point that a brand, a company, a government like has on us isn't particularly useful. A single data point about a single point of behavior. It's only really when we either aggregate all of that data up across different parts of our life or over different time periods, or aggregate across users, that that becomes valuable. And so I do see a disconnect sometimes between a sort of demonization of use of data and maybe misunderstanding as to when it becomes valuable. Any individual data point in its own right, maybe not, but it's then when we then aggregate up that that there's probably something that we're starting to see the see consumers just learn more and more and understand more and more. And yeah, we'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. But that conversation around the data leads us very nicely into the second part of the podcast, where we hear more from you, Alex, in terms of what you're doing at M&S and how your first party data strategy is evolving. So to kick off, why don't you introduce M&S to those who aren't as familiar with it?
Yeah, great. Thanks. So M&S, also known as Marks & Spencer, traditionally a well-established retailer in the UK. So we've been around 135, 140 years selling clothing, homeware, food, we have bank products, utilities products. So real range of different things, both, and have both a physical presence and an online presence as well. Interestingly, to reflect on some of the points in this conversation so far today, we're also a really highly trusted brand and retailer within the UK. Someone that I think consumers look to as working in the interest of our customers and offering this really high level of service, whether that be in store or online. And so that's really interesting for us as an opportunity going forward, because now that area of trust is applying directly to usage of data and how you create value from that. So at M&S, our first party data strategy has really been in existence for probably 3 to 5 years or so. And started very much with how do we bring all of the data points that we have together across all of these different interactions. So across these different parts of a customer's life and shopping behavior, food, clothing, home, they're all very different and different ways that people are shopping. And there's a lot of them as well. So M&S's size means that we have around 5 billion customer interactions every year across different touch points, whether that be in store, online, through emails, through paid advertising. And we want to make sure that we know our customer best across all of those different touch points and bring that together into a single profile. So really the starting point for us was, how do we bring that into one profile and understand that user in entirety across time periods, across visits? Then there's like a really big focus on how do we ensure that we have high levels of consent, permission for customers? How do they control that data and interact with that, given some of the themes that Rachel, you've already highlighted of customers' understanding and of how that's used and going forward? And maybe just the final thing of sort of a core thing, way that we've thought about our first party data strategy, is really around the value exchange, which I think we've alluded to like a little bit as part of this conversation, particularly in the Apple case. But what is it that a customer gets back directly? How much of that is very obviously visible, like through our loyalty program Sparks, where you get personalized offers. There's a clear pound value associated with that. And that's only because you've given us permission and we know you. But then how do you create experiences across our website in store that make shopping at M&S better than shopping somewhere else? So I'll maybe pause there, but that's like a little bit of how we've been thinking about it so far.
That's like an enormous task, if you think about it. And the way you've just described it is that you embarked on this sort of first party data strategy, say 3 to 5 years ago. So I'm thinking you've got a massive team working on this with, I don't know, loads of tech tools trying to bring all of this together. And it's a big strategic focus for the business as well. Like, how is that playing out? These are all questions, you know. How is that playing out? At what level in the business is this stuff that's right up in the C-suite? You know, and have you thrown a lot of resources at it? And also, sorry, like 10 questions in one. If we're looking at the composition of the team, what kind of background of those colleagues come from? If they come from a data and tech background, if they come from a media and agency background, or if they come more from a marketing background?
Yeah, a great set of questions. And I can't promise that I'm going to be able to answer them all in order, at least. But this has been a strategic priority now for the last 3 years. So this is something we've communicated strongly internally, but also externally to investors as something that we were really going to put money and people behind. So to the question around investment, this is a sizable investment within M&S. That's hard to take initially, because quite often the value of cleaning up your data, bringing into accessible locations, creating visibility on how to use it, accessibility to use in data science models or whatever the use cases are, there's not always direct value that you can associate with that. And so this now becomes a really big cost line that didn't appear before. Mm. And the benefits realization takes some time to come through. Alongside that, then if we think about what are the types of people that we've had to bring into the organization and build up, we've gone from maybe a central team of sort of 20 to 30 to going on 200, 250 this year within our digital and data team at M&S. So that gives some sense of scale, and obviously mm-hmm. like a pretty big hiring plan we've had over Definitely. The last few years. And if I'm honest, the core of the skill set that we brought in as new has been in a sort of data and tech background. We have really strong marketing teams within the business already. There was actually pretty strong analytical capability already within M&S. And so really what we've looked to bring is the systems, scale, and automation that comes from that different way of approaching some of these problems. And as we look to our journey in the coming years and think about where the value is going to come from, my role really within M&S is how do we create value through personalization? So using that data directly with customers to improve that experience, whether that be product recommendations on the website, personalized offers through the loyalty program, emails that have the right content blocks that you actually care about, so that when you open it up, you don't just immediately go, this isn't a company that knows me. Personalized language even. And so it actually creates lots of interesting questions for as you start to use, if you really want to use first party data at scale, there's a whole process and organizational transformation to go through, because it's, as you alluded to, it's a different set of skills that are actually coming in. And I'm hoping we're moving to a world where we can scale personalized language, the emotions that resonate with you in the way that we speak to either of you through our content and emails across all of those touch points. And you can't do that manually. And you can't check every email, and you can't check every variation. So you have to flip the whole process on its head. But I think that the returns and rewards of doing that are huge, and the conviction that we have within M&S in our place as trusted brand, high levels of permission, high levels of engagement, reach across all these parts of a customer's life and experience, is that we're really, really well placed to do that. And so that's a core part of our strategy going forward.
It's so fascinating because I've now got about 10 million other questions and we won't have time for them. But it really, you know, from an outsider's perspective and just somebody that works in, you know, the marketing and advertising and media industry, makes me think about then what type of a business does M&S become ultimately? It's still a retailer and a seller of things, for, you know, let's put it in layman's terms. But then it also becomes basically a big technology platform to a certain extent. It has enormous data assets. It has enormous, like you've said, personalization capabilities, which can be used for a number of things. And so then from a business perspective, from a business management perspective, how do you sort of manage that as it goes along through the next couple of years from a strategic point of view and sort of, you know, grows and evolves? And quite frankly, it sounds like if you're going to manage to achieve some of what is in your strategic vision, you've really got the opportunity as a trusted and very well-known brand to completely reshape the way that people think about that high street retail experience. And yeah, so I, like I said, lots of questions. I'm not you know, distilling them very well, but I guess I'm wondering on a basic level, how do you sort of manage that? There'll be lots of, you know, sort of business and change management processes that you'll be using, but I'm thinking about practical things like, you know, you'll have interactions with lots of technology companies. You'll have interactions with, you know, lots of agencies, media agencies, creative agencies. Where in the business does all of that get managed? And, you know, is that, you know, and how is your team involved in that as well?
Yeah. Great set of questions. So I think, you know, as you've called out, what we're starting to build is a platform, a product internally, which is actually very different to how a retailer thinks about a product, which is a physical product. But actually so many things are common between the two and the approaches you take to design them. So what we've begun building internally at M&S is something we call Bullseye, which is our personalization platform, which effectively is from the collection of customer data through to the data science that we use to understand each individual, make predictions, who they are, what they like, the language that resonates most with them, through to actually executing those experiences across touch points. That product's going to take some time to build, and we're naturally look to build that out over multiple years. For us, the strategic question is, which are the things that we should build internally? Because M&S isn't going to become a tech company. But where can we actually bring the best of product technology, that thinking, that approach to doing things, to building products, capabilities, and bring that into a retail organization to help it operate more effectively? So really we're looking for, we think that our secret sauce is actually around our understanding of customers, our ability to make predictions about what they do, and amazing products that we are designed mostly private or own label, and amazing content that we create, and that brand feeling that so many people have. And so really it's like, how do we bring those things together, but then actually look to partner externally for the things that are more commoditized, or just that we don't think we can actually create a differentiation on. And so whether that be specific marketing or ad platforms. Right now, is it worth us building an in-house bidding platform? Maybe not. But once we built out the personalization capability, that could be something that we look to explore. And so, yeah, I think over time, it's very much a balance. And as you called out, this is within the context of an organization that's not as familiar with these approaches, these like ways of working, building products in this way. And so really, there's a whole education journey as we go through this process as well. And it's all about what my team and my wider team is building, helping us scale the things that we already do a really good job of. Like, how do we take what M&S was known for in the UK, amazing personal one-to-one service every time you went into a store? How do you take that across all touch points, whether they're in store, at home, on the move? But it's going to be tough. I definitely don't want to downplay the challenge, but as we've already called out, just a huge opportunity for us.
Yeah, it's super exciting time to be working for a company like M&S by the sounds of things. I do apologize, Matt. I just completely dived in there with 10 million questions.
No, I was just sitting here fascinated to listen. It's been absolutely wonderful. But yeah, unfortunately, that just about draws us out of time. But Alex, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a hugely fascinating conversation and looking forward to hearing from you more as you develop M&S's data program.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me.
And Rachel, thanks as ever for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
And thank you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's MadTech Podcast.